make sure this is on 10. Yeah. This is an interview with Carl Clifford for the Youngstown State University Oral History Program on the Korean War by Don F. Baker at 4444 La France Street, Newton Falls, Ohio, on July 11th, 1989, at 11 o'clock a.m. Okay, we got that out of the way. So, do you remember how you first found out about Korea and what you knew about it at that time?
I kind of had a feeling about Korea when I was in Japan in 1946.
Really?
Right, the war ended, and somebody talked at that time that MacArthur and some people were having a rough time in North Korea and the communists were coming and so forth. And I made a stupid statement at that time. I said, if this problem isn't straightened out in North Korea and somehow with the Chinese, we'll be back over here in a few years. And I was joking, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But went home, got out of the regular Marine Corps, went into the reserves with the K Company, 3rd Battalion, 25th Marines in Cleveland. Went to Baldwin Wallace College. Was 3 years into college. Korea broke out. Maybe 1950 or 51. I think it was the last part of 50. And November of 1951, I believe it was, Harry Truman said, all of you reserves can now come back and go to Korea.
All right. It's my understanding you were in World War II.
World War II.
Yes.
Before that, yeah. So a whole bunch of us from Baldwin Wallace College who were in the Marine Reserve in Cleveland, and why were we in the reserve? It was a nice weekend income, good weekend income. I was a first sergeant. We were building up retirement points, of which I received today. And we were performing a kind of a community service, too. We did several things for Cleveland and Akron and parades and things like that, see? So it was reserve, and we were training, but not as well as we could have been, because we really weren't very good at military things in 1950, 51, 52. Everybody used to say, well, how'd you win World War II? We just got the mostest, they're the quickest. That's all.
Really?
That's the only thing that we have more airplanes, more bombs. And if we'd have had all that stuff in 1941, the Japanese would never have attacked Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
Never would have attacked. But they thought, well, these bunch of lazy Americans, they ain't got no army, they ain't got no navy, they got no Marine Corps. In fact, in 1941, I only heard of the Marine Corps through my dad. I really didn't know much about it.
Mm-hmm.
I knew more about the Merchant Marine.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Heard a little bit about the Army. Then the next thing I know, my brother went in the three Cs. But I soon learned a lot about the Marine Corps. Well, anyway, getting back to Korea, your question, it's a long story. Next thing I know, Harry Truman says, want the reserve back over there. Well, they packed a bunch of us up, sent us to Seoul, South Korea, looked at our military occupational spec, that's your MOS.
You want to explain that a little bit?
Yeah, MOS means what were you trained to do in the military service, military occupational specification.
Okay.
Mine was a radio man, infantry radio man, but now I had gone to college, Baldwin Wallace College, for 3 years, and they said, well, we could use you. I was training to work in education, things like that. They said, well, we could use you in the training department back in the United States. Andrasek, who was a PFC, or a corporal at that time, graduated from Baldwin Wallace. He came back to the United States with us. He became a captain from a corporal to a captain and went back over to Korea. Bob Foster, a friend of mine, was in Baldwin Wallace with us, played on the Baldwin Wallace football team, went to Korea. We got him over there and said, his military occupational spec was an infantryman. They said, well, we don't need you as an infantryman anymore. We need you as a technician in some field. I don't remember exactly what it was. Andrasek had completed 4 years of law.
Mm.
So here was an infantry rifleman who now would have come back to the United States. And there were a lot of law cases at that time that had to be settled in military service, just like you were saying. I came back and went into kinds of training. So what started out to be an infantry conflict for me in 1950-51 turned out to be a training experience for me back at Camp Lejeune. So I came back from Korea after only about 30, 60 days, and ended up in the United States, and I really had an education, because at that time we had an influx of Marines. We were just getting reorganized again. Reserves, draftees, and so forth. Camp Lejeune went from about 5,000 Marines to well over 40,000 Marines in the next, 30, 60, 90 days, somewhere, 3 months. And they all had to be trained. So this was a good experience for me in a way. I was in the S3 section. S3 section is plans and trainings in the Marine Corps. Just because someone said, well, you're in education, you get in plans and training. So I went there and had to go to meetings at the division level. And they said, now we're going to form the 6th Marines. Trying to think of what battalions. Well, for 2nd, 3rd Battalion. And they set up commanding officers, and executive officers, and adjutant, and first sergeant. That's all they had. And the next day, in came truckloads of troops. Then out came a training schedule from the division that says, we're going to start off just like we're basic infantry people. And we started on basic infantry maneuvers. I thought it was good, because I had never done it before. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what platoons, remember, I'm all the way through World War II,
right.
But I didn't know what platoons really did and how the mortar companies worked and where you got the tanks from and so on and so forth. I was getting a big picture for the first time. So not only were we training them, but they were training us in a sense. We trained that outfit for about, I'll say 90 days in all kinds of infantry tactics and so forth. And then they went to Korea. And you turn around on Monday morning and here come another 15 or 20,000 young men, Camp Lejeune. And we turn around and did the same thing all over again. Rifle platoon tactics, infantry tactics, regimental tactics, battalion tactics. It's the first time I'd ever seen all this stuff worked out.
Mm-hmm.
And World War, I would like to have had all that training before World War II. In fact, it's amazing that we got through World War II, because I don't know. We have now at Camp Lejeune and in various other places, we have what we call ITR. Maybe you're reading the paper, young guys going to Marine Corps, you see them, they're going to Infantry Training Regiment, ITR. Well, now they're learning platoon tactics, squad tactics, battalion tactics, regimental tactics, because I don't know if you remember or not, but in World War II, in Italy, some of our infantry people wiped out some of our infantry people.
Mm-hmm.
In the Marshall Islands, the Marines one time were shooting at the 10th Army because, you see, we really didn't understand what everybody was doing. The Navy does certain things, the Army does certain things. In fact, I'm sure, maybe it's a rumor, I've never had it confirmed, I think we shot down one of our airplanes one time. I've heard that rumor. Mm-hmm. But they wouldn't put it in books and magazines and papers if it wasn't true. Well, it was because somebody captured some of our airplanes and decided to use them against us. And then when they came over, somebody said, all these planes are not ours. They're being flown by the enemy. To be specific, it was P-51s in Italy. And so we shot down, but the Army shot down P-51s.
Mm-hmm.
Well, somebody didn't get the word. And some of our pilots, some of American pilots, were still flying P-51s, and they were shot down by Americans. Now, I'm sure this has happened,
yeah.
But like I say, I wasn't anywhere where it happened, just rumor.
Now, you were in Korea itself for a short period of time, is that correct?
Yeah, clear over and clear back.
Okay, did you have any thoughts about becoming actively involved in Korea before they sent you? I mean, what were your feelings about that, having gone through World War II?
My personal feeling was I was a little scared about going back over there again, because being in the infantry, there's a lot of bullets whizzing around you.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like that part about it. But as far as feeling political about it, I wasn't sure all that was... I was confused at that point. MacArthur was right in what he was doing, but then he started going too far, if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
President Truman finally removed him from command in the Far East, brought him home. But you see, I didn't have an association with all that upper-level echelon business. The guy I associated with was, Chester Puller,
mm-hmm.
First Marine Division Commander. And that's the fellow I saw and heard from, and the people. And all we talked about was getting a job done and coming home. So many Chinese, this hill to take and that hill to take. And
right.
So as far as, I didn't even know what Congress was doing. I didn't know what the United States was doing. I didn't know what anybody was doing. So I had no feelings pro or con. I was just in the Marine Corps Reserve, and we were going over there to do a job that somebody told me was necessary to be done. And that's why I went over to Korea.
How big did you get over there?
By boat.
How long did it take?
30 days.
What was it like being on a boat?
We had, I had a rare experience there. We went in convoy. We loaded out of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The Marines come from Camp Lejeune, Vieques, Guantanamo, Panama, and join Marines from the 1st Division at San Diego, California, where we go by, and Seattle. So, in convoy. And we lost a propeller on our ship.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And we were short of food for a few days. We were just adrift in the Pacific Ocean. And so we had to eat oranges and a slice of bread for breakfast, orange and a slice of bread for dinner, and an orange and a slice of bread and maybe toast with a little cream chip beef or something. So supplies had to be airdropped to our ship, the SS Sea Sturgeon, I remember that, and keep us going until we could get to Korea. So we finally got there, and then Korea didn't look like anything I'd seen in World War II. It looked pretty modern,
mm-hmm.
having spent time in the islands, the Juro, Kwajalein, Okinawa, Guam. Didn't see much civilization, but in Korea we saw civilization. So this is a little different situation. And I don't think Korea, which was supposed to be now, I know this now, I didn't know at the time, would be in the United Nations show, wasn't it? And they were flying a blue flag with a white wreath, you know. And they were saying all of the troops. Well, I saw British Marines. I saw Canadian, French. Those are the three that I remember specifically. And United States Marines, and then a lot of United States Army. And it seemed like everybody had a different idea of what we were doing. That answered your question.
Yeah.
You know, the Army thought, well, we were going to occupy this whole peninsula. And the British were the ones that went with the Marines, went up behind the enemy at Chosun, and shut off the South Korean supply line. But what they didn't count on, now I gathered this after I came back from Korea, not while I was there. I had no idea this was going on at the time. In fact, I didn't even know where we landed when we landed at Chosun. My commanding officer knew,
mm-hmm.
Captain McQuay, but they shut off the supplies, but it wasn't the South, it wasn't the North Koreans we were in trouble with then. Coming over the hill, it's Chinese then, say.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we, United States foreign policy with China or whoever got into trouble. And that's about the time I came home.
Well, could you describe a typical day that you had in Korea?
Well, it was unusual. I was disattached almost as soon as I got there. They said, I don't know how you got here. You shouldn't be here. You should be back in the United States. That's what I said. Foster,
right.
Andersack, myself. And there were about, if I remember, it was a plane load of guys. We came back by plane. They wanted us back here right away. Because, as I said, Andersack wasn't an infantryman anymore. He was a lawyer now. And there was a dentist with us, a doctor. And in other words, everybody that had been to college.
And you were talking about the fact that they took you out of the assignment almost immediately.
Yeah.
So what did you do there?
One day, believe it or not, I was the non-commissioned officer in charge of unloading a ship. Never did that in my life. And Andersack, who was a lawyer, was helping me, because at the time I was a gunnery sergeant and he was a corporal or a sergeant, I don't remember which. But we didn't know at that time that we were going to go back to the United States. We didn't know why we had been put in this separate pool to help unload ships. The Americans were unloading equipment like mad in Korea at the time. That I know. So we took charge of a detail of guys that were over there grumbling and growling and saying we don't know what's going on, and everybody didn't, you know, but we're unloading the ship. So then one day while we were busy unloading the ship, some guy came down, some first sergeant from personnel or something, said, you and Andersack and Foster, and he named two or three other guys, got to go down and get on this plane, you're going back to the United States. Well, we're happy. You know,
I
mean, we said,
I can imagine.
Wonderful, because at this time, this was a staging area. I don't know if you know what a staging area is.
Why don't you explain it?
Well, equipment comes in off of ships one direction, and troops by the thousands come in another direction. Now you got to get troops and equipment together, and they move out into a combat area, into a demilitarized zone is what they call it. So we're literally like rear echelon motor transport people. Only we have nothing to do with motor transports. But this is where they put everybody when they don't know what the heck to do with them, because they've got them in the wrong spot for a while. You unload ships, you load ships, you help clean and arrange trucks to motor transport, but whatever they have you to do at this check-in station. You take one of the biggest check-in stations or lines of debarkation in the United States is Hawaiian Island, Henderson Field. They bring about 20,000 Marines in there. These kids don't know what the heck they're going to do there. And so they have them cut grass, straighten out lawns, or clean trucks and cars, and then clean their own equipment, and then train a little bit, and then have the afternoon off from 4:30 on. And that's about what I was doing. I had the afternoon off from 4:30 on, and I thought, I don't know what they're doing, but it seems like a pretty good job. I went, reported to a headquarters and service for sergeant, checked with him every day, and he didn't have an area for me to go to. So my Korean experience was not like a lot of people that were in an organized infantry company or something that went over and got assigned to an organized area to take care of. But after I got out of that, like I said,
What did you do with your free time?
We ran around the countryside, looked at different things and so forth. Got a little free time. Sometimes we didn't have a whole lot of free time, but like 4:30 on or 5:30 on or something like that, or after dinner, sometimes the USO would bring a movie in or something. And we see that. I saw movies, I think, 6 days a week, because there's no place to go or see, really. You couldn't get out of the area. There was... Korea wasn't really into a full-fledged battle yet. You know, they were getting ready.
Right.
Although the communists, or the North Koreans, had walked over the South Koreans pretty good. In fact, they had pushed our own 10th Army, which was over there at the time, right down to the end of the peninsula. See? So now it's time to push them back, and then I think they thought Korea would be a thing to be over with in just a little while, because this is the South Korean Army, and that wasn't going to be hard to take care of. I don't think they anticipated many casualties or anything else. But when the Chinese entered the thing, now we were in a war, called a police action,
right,
by the president, by Congress. It wasn't a war, called a police. Everybody had a joke about that. And the other thing I remember about Korea, and this sticks with me more than anything else, we got a pay increase. And you may think that's funny, but at the time we got the pay increase, we started paying income tax for fighting. That's like toward the end of the war, seems to me, I didn't smoke, but they used to put a warning on cigarette packs. Don't smoke this cigarette, may be dangerous to your health. Well, they didn't put that on the M1 they handed you.
Yeah,
no,
right.
This may be dangerous to your health. You get your head shot, get killed or something. So I came back, trained one group of men, went to Korea, trained another division, went to Korea, group of men. They became part of the 1st Marine Division, see?
Before we leave Korea, one other question. You said you went around the country a little bit. Could you describe what your impressions were of people or what you saw?
I didn't see many people. I didn't have an interpreter with us or anything like that. And it was agricultural, what I saw. And my brother, much younger than I am, is in the Air Force, been to Korea since I have. He said, you wouldn't believe the size of the cities, this roads, the cars, the factories, the McDonald's, the Coca-Colas, and all that. And I said, there were none of those things when we were there. It was an oriental community. The one thing, though, that I do remember about Korea at the time, thinking about it for a minute, when I was in church in Sunday school, I used to hear about missionaries going to Korea and doing work in Korea. And I was looking for that, and I didn't see any of it.
Oh, really?
I thought, you know, we've been sending money over here to Korea for, I met some Korean missionaries before I went to Korea. And they were telling how poor the people were and how they needed help in building schools and churches and all that. So I thought I'd see some churches and schools, but
No.
I was misled. There may have been some someplace, but I never saw them, you know. And that's the one thing I look for in Korea, work of missionaries. And everybody, you know, spoke Korean. We didn't understand them. They didn't understand us. After a while, we were getting a little better communicated. But that I remember about Korea. I didn't see any work on missionaries. And yet, you know, you hear about missions every week and every week. It's like you hear the people talk about we're building hospitals in India.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where they're at. There must be one hospital there someplace that we donated money to or sent doctors and so forth. But, you know, you'd think the way we were working at these things that there'd be a lot of schools and a lot of hospitals built by the Catholic Church, the Methodist Church, the Baptist Church, various other churches, are all doing missionary work in these countries. Where did it all go? I used to have a teacher in school that was a missionary in China for about 5-6 years. What work did they do?
Mm-hmm.
Look at China today.
Yeah.
You know.
Before they sent you over to Korea, did they give you any additional training, or did they just load you up and send you off?
Just loaded us up and sent us off, but we didn't have the slightest idea where we're going or what we're doing.
So there was no training to refresh you or anything of that type?
The best training I ever had was when I came home from Korea and helped train a division. That's really the first time that I knew what the heck was going on, because at Camp Lejeune was the first time I saw. We had what we called a mad moment down there at the end of our training, where we spent, somebody said, $1 million worth of ammunition, powder and so forth. What they would have was the actual aircraft came in, and they would drop flour sacks or stuff like that. But there was electric detonators on the ground that would blow up, so it looked like a bomb. So the actual aircraft came over, strafed and bombed. They would get off the target, and the Navy gunfire would come on, you see, and you'd hear this banging. And the infantry would be looking at all this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, spectators on the side could see the Navy off at a distance, the Air Force coming, and could see the Marines off there. Well, then, naval gunfire would take over, and maybe put in shells for 10 or 15 minutes. As soon as that lifted, I suppose because the guns got hot out there or something, I don't know, the aircraft would come in and do low angle strafing. Well, that all impressed you, sitting over here in the bleachers watching all this, softening up the enemy, supposedly. Well, there really weren't any enemy there, see. And then they'd say, well, now the Marines are going to land. This is a kind of a show. Now, all of a sudden, coming out of the woods, from backing away in the truck, would be the enemy. They had little red helmets, red stripes on their helmets. And you'd see blanks, of course, machine guns, and rifles, and mortars, and hand grenades and all this stuff. And it was a very impressive show, and of course the Marines won that battle.
Mm-hmm.
And it would take about 15 minutes to, but the booming and the crashing and the lights and the whole thing, it's called a mad moment. And it cost Uncle Sam a pretty penny. But that was the culmination of training. It gave you a lot of confidence.
Well, let's go into the Camp Lejeune experience. You were sent there. What happened when you got there? Did they train you to train people, or did they
When I went into Camp Lejeune, I reported to six Marine headquarters. Six Marines is a six Marine regiment.
Mm-hmm.
You probably aren't familiar with Camp Lejeune, but at Camp Lejeune, we have the 2nd Marines, the 4th Marines, the 6th Marines and the 8th Marines, there's four regiments, and the 10th Marines. 10th Marines were our artillery and tanks.
What's a regiment consist of?
Those three are supposed to be.
How many men in a regiment do you know?
About, if it's reinforced, give or take one way or the other, it could be 20,000 about.
Okay.
Yeah. So, now the 6th Marines, as an example, right now, are in the Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm.
Get across the streets in the 6th Marines. They'll come back, and the 4th Marines will go out there for a while. Lebanon, mm-hmm. They'll visit Greece, Italy, North Africa. I made that trip once, too. So you do that out of the 2nd Marine Division. The 1st Marine Division is still, right now, in Okinawa. And parts of the 3rd are over there, say. But I say parts because it's not a reinforced division or not really, but they could bring it up to strength in 5 minutes,
right.
I'm sure. So a lot of people, like myself, popped in and out of the 1st Marine Division at times during World War II. A lot of people from Pittsburgh and Pennsylvania area were in the 4th Marine Division. During the war, so we had three more divisions, 4th, 5th, and 6th. But right now we just have the 1st and 2nd, 1st on the West Coast, the 2nd on the East Coast. So in the 6th Marines, we were doing this training. But I don't think they do it this way anymore, because I don't hear the other young Marines coming back and tell me about it. But they do what they call ITR training, Infantry Training Regiment. When you come out of boot camp, you now go to ITR, I think it's 12 weeks, and they load them on the ship, take them off the ship, climb the ladder, get down the ladder, make up mock invasions and mock landings, see? And that's good training. But the Marines today are much, much better trained than we were in World War II. Much better trained. They have much better equipment. They didn't know what the heck they're going to do. Air Force, Marine Air Force, maybe you see the President's helicopter,
mm-hmm.
Says U.S. Marines. Well, there's a whole bunch of them somewhere in Cherry Point or East Coast here. And the men that work with them are the same men that land in them and come back and take off in them. But before, it wasn't that way. They didn't have a striking force as such. Guys used to say, well, what plane are you going to put me on? Well, they don't ask that question anymore. They already have a seat assigned,
mm-hmm.
And they know exactly what plane they're going on. And the pilot knows exactly where he's going. And when those guys get through doing whatever they're doing, where he lands them, they come back and get in the same airplane. The only ones that wouldn't would be the casualties. And there are extra aircraft taken along to outload the casualties.
Mm-hmm.
So today, everything's done on a computer, you know. They know exactly the percentage of casualties they're going to have in a battle or anything like that. And that was partly what we were learning to do in the 6th Marines of the 2nd Marine Division. Yeah.
Well, could you go through a typical day at Camp Lejeune with you as a
typical
trainer?
Typical day for me would be to get up about 6:30, being a staff NCO. I didn't have to sweep and swab my deck. I lived in a little room with another staff sergeant, gunnery sergeant, master sergeant. There was two of us to a room. We had pretty nice quarters. They were air-conditioned, good bunks. The troops still slept out in the actual barracks. And go to chow, sometimes run to chow.
Would they feed you?
With the troops. Yeah, we eat the best, this is my opinion. Other people have different opinions. We eat the best food there is to eat in the Marine Corps. I could have bacon and eggs for breakfast, cereal, several choices of fruit, whatever you wanted. The only question they ask in the Marine Corps is if you take it, you eat it. You don't throw it away. And that's a rule. And you better stand there and eat it. If you take it, you eat it. If you don't want it, you tell the guy when you're getting the food. I don't eat that many eggs. They take some back. But if you take it, you eat it. They don't waste food. I saw some girl one time, she took too much food. And she was standing over by the garbage pail. There was an OD there, officer of the day. He said, you're not going to throw all that food away, are you? And he says, you eat it. You take it, you eat it. And she couldn't eat all this food. And I'm telling you, I think she's almost getting sick eating food. And she took it. She didn't know she's going to have to eat. So it's a pretty good rule. I don't know if they're the same way today. But during the war years, during Korea, we didn't waste an ounce of food. But anyway.
Why'd you have to run to breakfast?
Physical training.
Oh.
Yeah. If you're
not the first sergeant, and I wasn't down at Camp Lejeune, of the gunnery sergeant, and you're under 30 or 35 years of age, you still take all the physical training with the rest of the troops. You have to be in shape to stay in the Marines to be promoted. If you get fat, floppy, and lazy, you get discharged. It's that simple in the Marine Corps. You have to pass a physical every year. You have to fire your rifle every year. A rifle isn't something that you carry around and never put a bullet. You familiarize yourself every 6 months, and you qualify every 6 months, which means twice a year you're on the range.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't want to shoot, you don't want to be in the Marines, because you're going to shoot the Marines.
Yeah.
Everybody. Photographers. We even took our Navy corpsman with us. You know, in the Marine Corps, your medical supply comes from the Navy. And after breakfast, walk back to the barracks, pick up the troops, go to an assigned training area, be there by 8 o'clock. There, sitting, waiting. And the training may come from a division level, a regimental level person that day. Different types of training. If you're teaching machine gun operation, that's taken care of by the machine gun people, see, in their area. But if they were teaching like an overall air-to-ground landing situation, they'd have a large screen up there, and big instructor that's been through it several times, and he tells about the various phases. You do that at 8 o'clock, take a 10-minute break. You used to have a smoke break, see?
Mm-hmm.
You train something else at 9 o'clock, maybe something else at 10 o'clock. A little physical fitness before you go back to the barracks on the way back, or some optical course or something like that. Or walk back, maybe 2 miles to walk back. And that all was good training. Just walking back to your barracks, it's good training. Eat a good big dinner. Have a lunch.
What kind of lunch did they have?
Well, we ate a light lunch. You could have sandwiches, beans, whatever, you know. It was a pretty good lunch, really. Choice of drinks. Food was good. And, you know, you'd run into a guy and say, hey, this is lousy food. But I ran into a lot of guys that said, hey, I love it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
One of the guys that was with me is over in Barberton, Ohio now, Don Blinn. And he and I used to eat dinner together every day. And Don weighed a lot. Weighed about 250, about 6'2", 6'3". And he ate all he could eat. And they never turned him down on anything. And he had to watch himself not to eat too much, because he'd put on more weight to go up to 275 real quick, and then he couldn't run out of the helicopter real quick or something like that. So, because he knew he was going to have to run or carry somebody or something like that. So we get back, and at the end of the day, you had a choice of a movie, or somebody get a pass to get off the base altogether, overnight pass. We're in Jacksonville, North Carolina, and USO dances in there, moves in there. Some guys like to get off the base.
Mm-hmm.
Me, I didn't. Now later, at Camp Lejeune, my wife came down, okay? And we stayed in a trailer, right in the staff trailer housing down there. We had a good family. My daughter was born down there, Tricia. And you go out next morning, maybe the training would be maneuvers out in the field. Do that all morning. Squad tactics, platoon tactics, regimental, battalion tactics. You'd see all this stuff. You'd get an idea of what's happening, and you wouldn't be alone. We'd get to see on these things I'm calling maneuvers and war games, things like that. We'd meet Marines from Texas and Tennessee, mm-hmm. and they have a little more gung-ho spirit down that way than we do here in Ohio. But it was interesting.
What do you do specifically?
Well, before this operation would take place, I would have the job of helping to organize the operation and the plan in the S3, that's plans and training. And we'd get the word from the division and from the regiment, and I was in the battalion, S3. Mm-hmm. And we'd take our section out of this overall operation order, plan it out. My commanding officer, Robert Laufer, the S3 commanding officer, and you knew you were going to have so much ammunition, so much gasoline, so much trucks. You ordered transportation. The S4 is the transportation department. You just send a request down to them. They knew what they had to have. The S2 is intelligence. The S1 is the administration. And there's four functions of these of this operation, see? S1, S2, S3, and S4. So I was in S3. And we're plans in combat, we're plans and operations. In civilian life, or when we're not in combat, we're training, plans and training, educational section of the Marine Corps. So I knew pretty well where we were going, what we were going to do, and what we're supposed to do almost a month ahead of time. Almost a month ahead of time, you'd write out these orders. So that's what my day would encompass after I'd get through with this training business. If I wasn't on the training that day, and sometimes I was, I had about four or five enlisted men working for me, and we'd retype up these training orders, right according to Marine Corps regulations, you know. There's a book in there that tells you how to do it. And that would take sometimes late into the night. I can remember working on operation orders sometimes right through the night.
Really?
Yeah, all night long. And then you'd have maybe a few days off. You do work on operation order, you have light days. You go out and take part in training yourself, or somebody'd say, well, we're going to have a night compass march now, and here are the grid coordinates, and here's where we want to go. Can you go take a compass and see if you can do it? So I'd take myself and two or three of the guys, we'd take a compass and go out through some woods we never saw before in our life, and see if the compass thing would work. Because now, in the next two or three days, you're going to take maybe three platoons through there. A platoon of men of about 41 men each platoon.
Mm-hmm.
You're talking about losing 120 men. If it doesn't work, see? So you go out and do it yourself first. If you're going to have a firing, live firing, that's different than dummy practice. Live firing at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, we fired toward the ocean. Well, I'd go out sometimes and see the artillery fire, and the shells would land out in the ocean. The Navy would stop all the ships from running up and down the East Coast, the aircraft up above it, make sure no airplanes flew through the area. And see some 155s, which were made right out here at Ravenna Arsenal.
Oh, really?
And 105s. I saw that Ravenna, Ohio, right on the box a lot of times, you know, when I see them uncrate the ammunition. And sometimes go through live firing on mortars, and that can be dangerous.
Why is that?
Mortar isn't packed correctly. It's supposed to land out here 200 yards. It pops out of that tube and lands about 20 feet from you.
Gee.
Yes, sir. We killed 22 young men one time.
Oh, my goodness.
At Lejeune with short rounds from a mortar tube. And the first time you know it's when the first one comes up short. And then everybody screams and yells and jumps for the ground.
Who's fault's that? The manufacturers?
Yeah. Somebody right back there to Ravenna Arsenal, you know. If I'm not sure that's where that came from, the mortar ammunition. Because I only saw 105s and 155s in Ravenna Arsenal. I don't know where mortar ammunition, but I do know we had some Marines killed with short round. So a mortarman is always concerned that when he says one on the way, that he sees it leave. Just so it goes out there 100 yards or 200 yards or 300 or 400 or 500, you know.
You can actually see the mortar show.
Well, you can see it go, sure. Just go, little puff there and takes off. But if that thing goes up there and runs out of propellant and doesn't go anywhere, it comes back and the explosives are still in. It's going to explode when it makes contact right out there 20 yards from you. Somebody's going to get hurt seriously. Same with the guy that freezes with a hand grenade. You got to throw the thing. And the first time in the Marine Corps where we have guys throw hand grenades, an experienced Marine is behind him at all times. And you're in a hole. This is part of our training. I went through this quite a few times. And you pull the pin to hold the spoon down, see?
What's a spoon like this? Safety
this little handle comes down inside the grenade, and you tell him, throw. And if he don't throw that thing, you then take his hand and knock it out and put it over the side of this little sandbag entrenchment you're in, because that thing's going to explode. Now, it doesn't have heavy explosive in it. It's called training explosive. But it's going to do enough that somebody's going to get seriously burned if you don't get it away from you.
I'm going to stop here and turn this thing over so we don't run out of tape.
Okay.
There, it's going again. Okay, you were talking about better training. You thought, could you compare the training in World War II and the kind of training that you're giving to these guys in Korea?
The training that I had in World War II, was so much hustle, and so much rush, and so much immediate emergency. you didn't take time to do the kind of training that we had time to do during Korea. There's good training going on in the Marine Corps right now, but I doubt if the fellows that are being trained can see what they're being trained for.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm sure it's being explained completely. They can't see what they're doing, as I didn't when I was younger.
Mm-hmm.
When you're at the bottom of the ladder, the people at the top all know what's happening, but you just do your little thing. The training is much, much better now. World War II, no. We didn't have time. We just loaded guys in. My brother was also in the Marines. He went overseas with a 1903 rifle. That's a bolt-operated rifle, Springfield 1903, one round at a time. After he'd come back from Guadalcanal going to Peleliu, they issued him an M1. Now, an M1, you put 8 rounds in at a time, and you could issue him automatic. He was still reaching up trying to pull the bolt back sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody was using weapons. The M1 won World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So I got a Jap rifle right back there. After he fired one round, he had to reach over, pull that bolt back, shove it all the way around. And our guys were listening for that. You could hear that bolt go home.
Mm-hmm.
And then our guys were hardening and whatever, just keep that area. They didn't worry about what, just, you know.
Are they still using M1s in Korea?
No. We switched to the M14 there.
We're now working for us.
It's a version of the M1. The M14, much quicker. Now we got the M16.
We're not much
quicker yet.
With the M14, I mean, was that semi-automatic too?
No.
It could be both.
Semi-automatic and fully automatic. Yeah.
You know how many rounds were...
Well, you could take and put a banana clip in there, and you'd have 30 rounds. But you didn't dare fire them right down. You'd turn the barrel up.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the thing so hot you couldn't hold it, you know. So you got to use judgment. Even though you see... Rambo.
Oh.
All the stuff he did, you know. You can't shoot guns like that. You burn the barrel. You got to shoot just a few short bursts. A few short bursts. And keep it cool.
Mm-hmm.
But even machine gun. They have to be able to stand. And one day, just for Maroney to do this, they have to get that thing off of it. And we've gone away from the water-cooled machine guns in World War II to air-cooled guns now. A lot lighter, more firepower. I don't know how anybody is keeping up a lot of firepower in combat now. They're doing the right thing when they think it's armed. Nobody can win. It's a losing situation. I'm sure that Russians and Japanese, and look at the Israelis. Sophisticated armaments have just put war to the point of the world. You're not going to have 10% casualties anymore. You're going to have 75% casualties with it, putting to death today. So disarmament is necessary.
But preparedness is still necessary.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have disarmament.
Yeah, okay. That's fine. But that doesn't mean send everybody home. You better have somebody here that's trained. Because you might
be. Are you familiar with the kind of weapons that we have then, the North Koreans and the Chinese? Were they comparable to ours?
At the end of Korea, the Chinese were starting to get pretty considerable. We were superior in weapons in the Korean War.
We could get more there. Mm-hmm. More supplies to our missions.
Our airplanes were superior.
Our basic instruments.
Through the education and so forth, is a better man for man than any army in the world. For instance, I was shocked. This is an example.
Not documented.
During World War II, the Japanese couldn't fix their own motor vehicles. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You see them stand there and they were mostly agricultural people.
Right.
They knew what a carburetor was and what anything was under that hood. See? But our kids were going around finding anything they could, and then wire it up and make it go. Well, they could run a Jeep, they could hot rod a tank if they wanted to. Our kids
could go out there and take it. I don't know. I mean, speaker, you could find some kids.
They could go wire up a vehicle and steal it right now, see?
They could steal it.
And the Koreans were still agricultural people. But our kids were still, you know, the food is going better the faster than we were. Together was a lot of fights about it.
Do you know anything about differences in methods of combat or whatever between World War II and Korea? Was it the same kind of war, same kind of methods, or was it different?
Yeah. Tactics have been pretty much the same since the Civil War. But having the men and the machines and the things to perform a certain tactic based on a certain train is why you train officers.
Mm-hmm.
There's places where you can use tanks. They bog down in the swamps and things. You're not going to use tanks on the side of a mountain, which we almost tried to do at Mount Sinai. So you can have all the tanks in the world, but if they can't get them where you need them, you can cut them down and fire them. They've got 90 millimeters and 105 millimeters on them. You can use them for artillery guns, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But, now the tactics is pretty much the same,
but the situation demands a different tactic for different situations.
We teach a lot of Marines about enfilade fire.
That's what it was?
Enfilade fire.
That's when fire stops it. Which is more pertinent than head-on fire. A lot of people think they all.
If the enemy's rushing here and you shoot at them like that, you'll win. You hear me?
You would if you got somebody on your flank and the fire is cracking.
Mm. That's on palatal fire.
You know how to spell that?
Yeah, I read it.
L-E-T-A-L, I believe. On palatal.
I would have never heard that term before.
I can believe it. I only saw it a few times and got the testing on the things of what's the most effective type of fire in such and such a situation.
Mm-hmm.
So they teach us pretty early that way over your side,
yeah.
Far left or far right. You advance forward by looking back.
There's no use running way out here and
find yourself getting cut off and captured at the waist.
You need to go forward
as well as you have supplies right behind you that will let you go forward.
Be a John Wayne hero. All that stuff that John Wayne did isn't true.
Talking about leaders, what did you think of the leaders that you had? Like your officers and people like that.
I have the utmost respect for almost all of us. There's always one that doesn't carry a load. But of all the leader officers,
I had a lot of respect for them. They were good men. So well trained.
I think back to the reserve again.
I came back to the same reserve outfit.
Oh,
I
really?
Left. Yeah. I didn't learn anything. See, I wasn't very bright. So.
Yeah, I really had a good bunch of men. And Tom McClay, who's a assistant high school principal at Boston High School, was my reserve commanding officer again.
Mm-hmm.
And good man. Good teacher.
Good administrator, fair,
very firm, very serious about it. Doing a good job. I don't know how to describe them as people, but they're people like, they're not going to burn the flag.
They're not going to show disrespect for America.
But they're also respectful of elderly people. Not people that are in trouble. People are going to go with the old
system of knighthood, I look at that way.
Mm-hmm.
Tom McQuay and some of the guys I was with in the K Company 3rd Battalion, they said, we got to go and help somebody that's in trouble. They were going to be like, we go.
Mm-hmm.
They help me. They things done like that. So it isn't just a military thing, it's kind of a bond, you know,
mm-hmm.
when you look at it.
If I had to go back in combat again,
with Tom McQuay, I'd go tomorrow because I'd know that he would know what we were doing was the right thing to be doing.
And we would do it the right way. We have no chances and still have success. He's a very skilled commander. He's not a guy that's just going to
We went out and spent a lot of time in the evening. I don't think you knew it, but when I was still teaching in the staff, he used to train officers and arsenal. Back in them swamps back there, we'd divide up our regiment out of actors, and half of them would come over here and put on light armbands and beat the pitch on them. They'd get in there. They'd get that hide from it. And we'd be defended for the week, and we'd have to try to find them, and capture them, and, you know. So they'd use all the tricks they knew to avoid us, and we'd use all the tricks we knew to find them. And,
very black ammunition. There's a lot of good training out. You can
make your face, and you can get killed, but you won't kill.
That's for sure. You have to,
have a feeling for what you're doing. You have to have done it. Let's talk about it.
You have to have done it. A lot of the experienced Marine officers are not there anymore.
There's a lot of Korean people, a lot of World War II people. And the Vietnam people are different. They didn't have
mechanized. And I don't think as well schooled as the Korean people.
No, they're not. But you got to take time.
And understand what the heck happened to Gettysburg.
Mm-hmm. You got to take time to understand what killed you.
So education goes on. I would like to someday, this would be the real thrill. I'd like to go to the War College in Washington, D.C.
Oh, really? If you want to look at the maybe you can get a fellow, and do it again.
I'm sure I couldn't go to it, but, you know, just get a... I'd like to see what they're teaching. Good day.
You really look at their practice and listen to what happens.
Because that's where the thing is went awry.
In the training and education.
Making that mistake.
You want to be able to use it? I cannot. Look right out there in Vietnam, less than 2,000 years.
You're captured.
Really?
That's good. Compared with the sum
of 15,000. Now, some of them might say, well, that's what Trump has in the room. They're going to have to go by me. Well, we had a couple of divisions over there.
And they had a 10th Army Division, a different outfit. But percentage-wise,
like the same number, too. But the same driver was probably going to say, you know,
I've looked at the, I get a Marine magazine here monthly, yeah.
How many have I had to do this? And how many have I had to do this? Look at all the things I have to do. I don't know if I have to do this. I don't know if I have to do this.
Just a couple more general questions.
Yeah. You think you have any opinion about whether you're training to the side of the desert or whether you're training?
MacArthur was speaking from a military point of view. And Harry Truman, of course, he was a captain of World War I.
They let them know that back then. But he thought the
civilians should have handled that situation. I'm not exactly sure.
Okay.
I'm not exactly sure.
It would be nice if, like, you know, you could get out on Monday and
see how the game was played Saturday.
Right.
But I'm sure there's still people writing around saying the Vikings should never have been fired. They could let him go on and go on into North Korea, and I'm not sure that's true. So that might have got us into a big war with China. And I don't think he'd win that one. On land, he'd make a big chance to make a coup. But there's other people saying, you know, he was right. They got him out of there right away because he didn't know. So he did get him out of there, and they did it in there. Well, we still have good people there. They're going to Korea right now. So, Korea isn't really settled. But what we're sitting here talking,
with a light up there, and there's an army officer over there doing duty the other day. In some cases, they're being fired upon. In some cases, they'll be getting fire. And Henry's gun is still there. And there's still barbed wire on their side of the line, and barbed wire on our side of the line. And we're walking sentry duty. They have the North Korean, they're trying to get into South Korea, and the South Korean trying to get in. It isn't over. It is not over.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's going to be over for a little while, so they have jobs, they're trying to be going correct, and they haven't got time to go out there and cause this trouble on that border line. But, no, it's not over right now. We're setting this happen. And it's pretty rough tomorrow. Well, that's a sad fight, isn't it? In the United States, we've got, one or two armies over there now. Army is four divisions in there. So they have a Marine Corps, it's only three divisions or less. It's not an army. It's just a corps. And there's no doubt in my mind that we would bring men right up from Okinawa, right into Okinawa. And we'd be right back to where we're talking about now.
From the perspective of today, do you think Korea was a necessary war, and what did you think at that time?
Well, at that time, I thought it was necessary. Now, I think we can win the war economically.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are, suddenly talking, and President Bush spoke in Poland, so
right.
That, to me, is winning the war economically. As without shooting men and bullets and stuff like that. I'd like to find an economic way of keeping everybody with butter and money and everything in North Korea, keeping them happy. They don't have to fight then. Because the reason to fight is you want something that they got in their backyard.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to defend it. Somebody said, oh, we shouldn't have to fight. Well, you're going to have to win democracy in every generation if you want to keep freedom. One way or another, I don't know, you might not have to do it on the battlefield again. If you're going to do it with words. I'd like to see the battle with words. I think we can win this battle.
Mm-hmm.
Too bad we couldn't spend a little more time talking before it's really broke down. But you can't talk. I'm sure with what Korean soldiers I saw, you never talk to them. You can't talk to someone with 17. They got the same education and the same feeling about freedom that you have. They look for a lot of things just to go there and die. They didn't want to do that. So until they're educated about their system or something and get off of this communist fanaticism, you know, America is a bad country and let's just fight the Americans, it didn't work. Japan, how they prospered after they fought it. That's how fantastic Germany is becoming here. That's their product, our enemy. And there are guys in Germany have better jobs than people in the phone. You know, it's the battle of words now, and it's better. It's better. But you still have to be prepared for that guy that has more talk. There's somebody out there that still thinks the guns are better.
Mm-hmm.
It's that guy over there in Lebanon.
Gaddafi.
And the other guy running around with a big feet in his head. He didn't have to win it.
Arafat.
He's running around, and he's not walking silently. He's carrying a big stick. He's carrying a big stick and making a lot of noise. And so he's one of those guys who would like to have his way with words and bullets. Okay? But he doesn't fight one. He's smart enough. He's been out in New York and a couple other places. He now knows the world bigger than what he thought it was. He thought it was just Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Iran, and a few things like that. And he's going around the world and I said, oh my God, there's more people out there than I thought. Maybe we don't want to have this war, you know. So he's yellowed a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But way in the back of his mind, he's an old war horse, and he'll fight. And you've got to keep him in check all the time.
We hear a lot about Vietnam and veterans today, and very little about Korea. How do you feel about that?
Oh boy, I lucked out real good. I went over to Korea and came back. I ended up staying here. I had a daughter there and a few things. Took a married life. defend the fourth guy. So he put in the stone stuff like I didn't come home very recognition. Not as a citizen from World War II or Korea. It doesn't do anything for me. I don't think you need recognition. You went over to protect your life and freedom and democracy and your country and so forth. And you come home and I came back to a good job and had a good life and I'm alive and I don't complain. I don't want no money. You know, I don't think it's necessary. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people making a lot of noise about it. But I just wonder who these people are. You know, I think sometimes there are politicians that want recognition. It's like a man standing up and yelling about abortion. Mm-hmm. They ain't had no babies. Let the women talk about that. You know, I don't know if they want to talk about whether I'm going to pay for a woman to have an abortion. I'd like you to know if they can have. But as far as whether they can have a baby or not, I don't care. But if they're going to ask me to pay for it, I care about that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two sides to the abortion, the economic side and the moral side. And I don't like to mix the two. So that's really the way it's going. A lot of things. We don't need to create a monument. Well, it's like someone said, well, here again in metal. Yeah, they say the metal. So what are they for? Well, you don't really remember that too much either. You get a medal for being in this area for a certain amount of time. I'll tell you, when things were happening, I wasn't sitting there saying, my God, I got a medal today. You know, it's like keeping up for it. I came home, and somebody said, you get a medal. But I don't know. You know, what for? It's like right now. They're giving out medals to those who are prisoners of war during Korea, and even during World War II. The president signed, and Congress has made a special medal. Well, I stuck my head about that. The last thing we wanted to do was become a prisoner.
Right.
Okay? How would you give a guy who didn't get his job done, got captured, a medal? Are you mean to tell me that the next time we have a little battle here someplace, it's better to get captured because you can get a medal? Well, all prisoners of war are getting a medal, see?
Yeah.
And in some cases, they're giving extra bonuses to prisoners of war. I'm not sure about that. In our office, we talked about not becoming a prisoner. We talked about if we had a choice to take as many of the enemy with us before they got up. I mean, maybe that's possible, I don't know if it isn't. But most of the Marines I know, that wasn't possible. They would take as many of the enemy with them right now, knowing that that's maybe the choice. If you're going to get up to prison, you might get killed anyway. After they get the information, they went, well, you're no longer valuable to them. So being a prisoner is no big deal. Another thing I had a real good shock about was ridiculous, July. It had to be about April or May. They came around and gave all Japanese during World War II to remove from the left face in the prison that some of us $20,000. Well, now that made me scratch my head. We were born in the food service. In 1948, one, and they were getting $18.47, $18.37 for time that day. It went up to $37.50. When I went to service, I was getting $50 a month. I didn't know what to do with all the money. $50 a month. But they give me food, they give me a clothing place to sleep. That's the main expense I didn't take. Then they raised their pay to $75. Now, a private in the Marine Corps gets something like $250 plus all these other clothing, food, and allowances. Now, if he's got a wife, they're paying extra money for the wife. They're paying extra money for his housing. So he's getting $300,000 a month. Now, a private, where we get $50 a month. Did I say that? That's way. So how much is the Holly North retirement that they just took away from them? $23,000 a year they took away from them. Now, that, to me, they didn't take it away from them. They took it away from his wife and children. That retirement that he earned legitimate, put away.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's coming to him. But he's trying to take on the life of children. You know, that's a little bit too far. And as far as all the noise is concerned, there isn't any man in the service that would do the same thing. You know,
mm-hmm.
You cannot go around selling soaps and messing by them. I say it's pretty when you can't get out of drunk driving. Soaps has been arrested twice for drunk driving. And he's down there asking this man, college educated, trained military officer, why he didn't tell him the truth about what's going on. If Holly North tells this man what's going on, and he tells the newspaper, the people that Holly North worked for and they're going to think he's the more he talks like we're talking now, the people will die. Because the American Constitution doesn't apply to Iran.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't apply to Iraq. They don't give too good of a gift about this. Our Constitution, oh, it's a wonderful thing for us to have. You know, it's easy to be a hero here in the United States. We've got all kinds of protections and freedoms. So go out in Iran and see how tough you are. And that's where he lives,
mm-hmm.
where he can get shot of the day. That's where he was dealing. There's no doubt he probably did some things. Well, I'm sure you did a lot of things right, as far as I'm concerned. And there's no way for Congress to find out what he's doing. Congress should have asked his immediate superior, Lieutenant General, Full General, Paul Kelly, who had been a man in the stand. And they should have said to him, did you give, you are the commandant of the Marine Corps, did you give Lieutenant General Oliver North permission to do this, this, and this? The Commandant of the Marine Corps is responsible for the Marines. What was he doing in the White House? Who put him in there, say? Just to the people that was in charge, surely a Lieutenant General isn't running our foreign policy, but he told the same as any sergeant. If I was captured, what am I supposed to do? Three things. I give my name, my rank, and my serial number. If they ask me if I get mail, the answer is, I don't know. If they ask me how old I am, I don't know. If they ask me where I live in the United States, I don't know. If they ask me my congressman, I don't know. Who's my wife? I give three things, my name, my rank, and my serial number. Tomorrow morning when they question me again, I give them my name, rank, and serial number. That's by Geneva Conference. That's the world's third of military evidence. Nothing else. To my congressman, to my president, to no one. Name that as your name. But to my commanding officer, who assigned me to this job, I answer his question.
Mm-hmm.
So my commanding officer is the responsible individual. He sort of says, well, you know, what's that reality of with what happened in Germany? You know. Those were generals that were in charge of prison camps. They made the decision. Holly North was like my commanding officer, like commanding officer, Lieutenant General Crickett. And he's responsible for me. But not doing all these things. He didn't form our world policy. This is what I'm saying. I don't think they got the right guy. I'm sure I noticed that Paul Kelly kind of got out of the Marine Corps at about the same time that Lieutenant General Norton was on the stand, and that's probably the smartest move he made. Now we have Commandant Gray in charge of the Marine Corps. And he's changed a whole lot of things. There are no Marine officers in the White House lately. All Lieutenant Generals are at the regimental level where they're supposed to be. Okay? I never quite understood that myself, what they were doing there. We have internal reference people, you know, that CIB and CIA and all these people are foreign policy. Let them do it. I'll grant you, Lieutenant Colonel North is probably a pretty good man. He was a Marine and could have done a Marine Corps. Good Marine thing. Something is wrong, something like
that. Well, let's finish up. Is there anything else you'd like to add that we didn't cover?
Yeah. Would be nice to cut our national budget, but unfortunately, no women. But can you do it? You know, can you really honestly do it? Gorbachev is saying we should cut it. We'll cut it. Yeah, I think we had a mad cat. I'd be nice if we could cut it. but I don't think we can go so far back that we're like we were at the beginning of World War II. When we couldn't even defend our own naval ships in our own naval yards, that was bad. When my brother had to train with a broomstick, that's a fact. He trained with a broomstick in World War I. When he first got a rifle, they gave him an outdated one. 6 months later, they gave him a new one. We had no idea what the heck, how to shoot it, or anything else. Now that's not right. I think we ought to be training with the latest equipment, hoping that we never have to use it. I'd like to believe in a good, strong, civilian reserve. That's what I did in reserve. I thought that my training, while I was in the armed forces, went to camp, stayed on the side, did all the things, but it cost money to keep trucks and tanks and pilots and everything. 7 days a week, we don't take care of it. They're expensive, all that food and all that clothing and everything. It'd be nice if we could have everybody at home and equip them in their kids. A couple other countries have an armed reserve that you serve them. And then it happens. The way that you can pick up the phone you call them, you can get them all together. They do, I think they can do 50% job. And you can have a full-time paid army. If you pray, you need to answer that way. Don't let it finish up there, you know. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see it save a lot of money that way and put it into worthwhile endeavors. You can talk about anything you want to. Hospitals, roads, jobs, and then schools. All these things you're doing, the armed forces, is expensive. Unfortunately, you might have to cut that budget, but not to be expensive when you're losing something. You've got to be able to weaken before World War II.
Well, I'm really appreciating you. Well, I've given you all this time and everything. It's really helpful to me. And
well, I had one person that had one idea, and it's probably not correct.
Well,
but it doesn't matter if you go do this, John. I appreciate this. Because somewhere, we've got to accumulate a lot of opinions and a lot of men. It would be nice if we could sit here with Seth Sapor in this room this morning, the commanding general of the 1st Marine Division Korea, and get his point of view. All I ever heard him do was bark orders out to the men, you know, and got us to get on the ball and get this done. But I'm sure deep down in his heart at night, he had to be thinking about the maneuvers and the operations and the movement of men. You sat there, and he sat about that same distance from me one time, and he asked me, who do you talk to? He asked me, he said, what do you think General do? And I said, sir, I don't know. I have a lot of respect for him. I don't know. He said, you know, a good general is going to make sure the men have their mail, their money, a place to sleep, plenty of food, and they're taken care of. He said, I bet you thought I was a warlord or something, didn't you? I said, yes, sir. He said, that's something we do too in our spare time. But he said, if you don't see them, and I'll use a couple of words he would have used, and get them a slap of beer and smoke and get them in the mail, keep them morale high. He said, if you don't have a division name, a bunch of division drummers. And he knew more about a general's job than I thought he knew. He didn't just a good word general, but he was just a he's the one for privacy when he came back.
Mm-hmm.
And then he got a little bit too old to set him aside. But I never thought about a general being responsible for my mail.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, you got to get the mail. So guys want to hear from home. You got to feed him 3 meals a day. So he says, I have to go down there and see what the effects are doing. I said, really? He said, yeah, I know an officer in charge of the cell hall. But he says, I want to go with that officer and go to just to kill him with a big man. And he says, I got to make sure that the food gets there, the money gets there. Everybody likes to be paid. And I want the morale to be high. We had basketball teams, you know, rapping, whatever. And he's just young. I didn't know that was his job. I thought his job was to plan out where we were going to go. Who we were going to shoot, yeah.
Right.
That was the last thing. I didn't worry about that.
Thank you.